MacCast, Wednesday, May 9th, 2012. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam. This is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. I hope you are having a great week. Things for me, as always, are extremely busy, but I've been keeping up on what's going on in the Apple and Mac communities, and I have a bunch of great stuff to share with you. Of course, before we get into all of that, we will take a moment and thank one of our show sponsors, and that's Furonix, makers of Deep Freeze. You know, I just did an episode for MacCast members on what to do with an old Mac, and I think one of the great uses for an old Mac would be to repurpose it as an internet terminal inside your house, maybe in a guest room. So when your guests come over, they can have a Mac sitting there in their room ready to go. They can surf the web. They can check up on their Facebook account. They can do online banking, pretty much anything that they want to do. You know, so many services offer web-based email so they could log in and check out their email. And with Deep Freeze, though, they could even launch mail.app and configure it with all their account settings and access their mail directly from the native application. Because what's great about Deep Freeze is you can set up that old Mac, that old terminal, you can load Deep Freeze onto it and lock that configuration in place, meaning that however you have it set up before your guests arrive, that is the state that it's going to stay in and return to once they leave, because all you have to do is do a simple reboot and the Deep Freeze software will kick in. It will clear off all of the temporary data, any settings changes, anything that the person did during their visit, and reset all that stuff. That would include security logins and cookies and all that sort of thing. So that's the kinds of stuff that it does. It does a whole lot more than that, but this would be a great application as this sort of guest terminal. It's actually what the hospitality industry uses. A lot of the hospitality industry uses Deep Freeze to do exactly this. They can have computers, Macs, and PCs in guest rooms and use the Deep Freeze software to keep the customer's data secure. So check it out. They have free trials and more information available on their website. You can find that at furonix.com. And a big thank you to them for their support of the MacCast. So lots going on in the Mac Apple community. We're starting to get rumors now of new Macs on the way. We've had these for a while, and specifically a lot of the rumors have focused around the MacBook Air. Mostly we've been hearing about maybe an update to the 13-inch or the 15-inch MacBook Pro. Well, this week, DigiTimes claims that there might be a new lower-cost MacBook Air in the works to compete with the low-cost Ultrabooks that are coming out from Intel. They claim that Apple is working on a $799 MacBook Air. I find this rumor to be a little bit dodgy, especially considering the source. DigiTimes isn't always 100% accurate on their rumors. The other thing about it is Apple tends not to play in that low price game. But, you know, maybe looking at the current generation MacBook Air, the 11-inch starts at $999, so a $200 price drop might not be that much of a stretch. Now, DigiTimes is claiming that that new model will be out later this year, and there's a lot of speculation that Apple would be doing a revision to the MacBook Airs later this year, specifically the 15-inch and 13-inch models. So I would imagine what they could do to achieve the lower price point is just retain the current specs on the 11-inch $999 model and just reduce the price by $200, leaving that as the entry-level model, and then update the newer versions with CPUs and additional upgraded specs and have those priced at $999 and, you know, keep the current pricing on those models. And this is a strategy that they've done several times. They're doing it most recently with, you know, retaining the iPad 2 and bringing out the new iPad 3s. So Apple does have a history of that, so I could see that happening. As far as them developing a whole brand new model to hit that $800 price point, I think that's a little less likely. Cult of Mac is also citing a reliable source that says Apple is working on a next generation television set. The iTV is kind of what we're all referring it to it, since it doesn't have an official name yet. But they claim that they've seen the actual iTV prototype. They said it has, and I don't find this surprising at all, an aluminum construction. It looks very similar to Apple's current LCD cinema displays, just much larger. They don't define how much larger. Speculation tends to be that Apple's working on a set in the 32 to 42 inch range. They do say that the set will feature Siri and FaceTime calling, along with face detection, a face detection feature, because as you're sitting across in a living room, you might be further away than you typically would be with a FaceTime call on the desktop. So the idea is the face detection would be able to recognize where you are and auto-zoom the camera into your location and even potentially follow you around the room so that you're always kind of front and center but don't need to be standing directly in front of the TV set. Sounds like a great feature, but I still question the fact that Apple's actually working on a television set. Some people feel that the Apple TV will hit the streets later this year, but a JP Morgan analyst recently claimed that he doesn't expect Apple to be shipping an actual Apple television set anytime before 2014. And I kind of fall in line with that. I think Apple's still playing around with current generation Apple TV set-top box. That gives them universal access to almost any TV set that's on the market, and I think they're going to continue to pursue that strategy, at least until they can work out some of the content deals and stuff like that. I think, you know, seeing a prototype in Apple's labs is likely possible. Probably exactly what this person saw. These are the kinds of things they're playing around with, but I really don't think that they're getting close to launching that kind of product anytime soon. The last thing we're hearing about in terms of new Apple hardware, DigiTimes is claiming that Apple's supplier Pegatron has received orders for new displays for a number of different iOS devices. Specifically, they're saying that there is a new iPhone due out in September. I don't think that's a shock to anybody. Most of us are feeling that the new iPhone, the iPhone 5, will come out sometime around the October, September, October timeframe. I'm putting it more in October, Apple's saying, on that kind of yearly release cycle, but it could be a little bit earlier. The other thing they're saying, though, and I put a lot less stock in this, and again, remember the source, this is DigiTimes, they're really hit and miss on their rumors. They're saying that a 10-inch iPad new screen is due out for the fourth quarter, which would mean Apple revving the iPad well in advance of that yearly release cycle, and I don't think that could happen. Now, what could be going on here is that Pegatron is typically an additional supplier for Apple, and they help supplement some of the Foxconn orders, so Apple could be just gearing up to have them producing more iPads, more of the current generation iPad 3s, or new iPads. I keep calling it iPad 3. Sorry about that. The new iPad in the fourth quarter. So that's more likely, in my opinion. The other thing that the DigiTimes report is saying is that Foxconn is also receiving shipments of a 7-inch screen component to be used in an upcoming smaller 7-inch iPad to be launched, they're saying, in August. I still have a hard time swallowing this 7-inch iPad rumor, but it's that one that simply won't go away. So I really feel that Apple has a prototype model, something that they've been working on. They've been playing around with different form factors. But as far as it being an actual shipping product, especially something that's going to ship in August of this year, I'm going to call fake on that rumor. In the August timeframe, though, as I was saying before, I do think that Apple is going to be gearing up and getting ready to announce the iPhone 5, and they seem to be making some preparations for that event to happen. They filed a claim recently with the World Intellectual Property Organization, WIPO, for the domain iPhone5.com. Right now, that site is a small forum and rumor site centered around the iPhone 5. It was launched around October of 2010. It does seem odd that Apple wouldn't simply try and contact the domain owners and buy them out. I wouldn't think it would cost them a whole lot of money to do that. But they have made similar domain trademark claims with WIPO in the past, including one for iPhone4S.com back in November of 2011. Apple is also slowing down, or reportedly slowing down, on orders for its iPhone 4S touch panel display components. Apple's two main suppliers of the touch panel components are both reporting that they expect to see about a 15 to 20% drop in shipments in the second quarter. We can assume that's likely due to Apple slowing down production on the current generation iPhone models in the lead up to the launch of the iPhone 5. So what does the iPhone 5 actually look like? At least one source claims that it's going to be taller, thinner, and have at least a partial metal back. This is according to iLounge. They say that a reliable source has claimed it will be about 10 millimeters taller than the current generation iPhone, and this is to accommodate supposedly a new 4-inch diagonal display. The metal back is going to cover just the central section, according to the report, and kind of leaving the two ends to still be glass. That glass is expected to be the new thinner Gorilla Glass 2, and because of that new material, the report is saying it would allow the phone to be overall about 2 millimeters thinner than the current generation design. The other thing in the report is something we've been hearing about from a few other sources, that Apple is moving to a new, smaller dock connector, which could potentially have fewer pins than the current 30-pin version. They're saying possibly as few as just 16 pins. Now, the iLounge piece does have a supposed mock-up of the device based on the specs that they've seen, and in looking at it, I think it looks really ugly. I think it looks like nothing that Apple would release. That sort of two-tone back with a giant metal chunk in the middle and the two ends being black, or glass, rather. I guess on the white model, it would be white on those two ends. But the thing about it is it just looks odd instead of having one seamless surface, which is typically how Apple would design their products. The report was kind of arguing that it was similar to the current iMac designs, which have a big glass front and then the metal along the bottom edge, you know, where the Apple logo is. But in reversing it, where you have a giant metal piece as the main portion and sort of these glass pieces on either end, it just doesn't look right to me. The aspect ratio is also a problem. You know, going to a 4-inch screen and making it 16 by 9, I know we saw some mock-ups related to that, and there's some people arguing for that aspect ratio. It causes problems for app developers and applications, and I think there's just no reason for Apple to move to that form factor. I personally look around, and this is just my opinion, I look at some of these 4-inch, 4.5-inch, 4.7-inch, almost 5-inch phones, and they're just large beasts that I think wouldn't fit in your pocket. And even having one that's a little bit taller, I like to slide my iPhone into my front jean pocket, and this was something that Steve Jobs would typically demonstrate on stage, the fact that these devices can fit in your pocket very easily. I think Apple's going to want to stick to that, so increasing the size, it just doesn't seem to make a whole lot of sense. Now, 10 millimeters isn't too much more, and if they can fit a 4-inch display in the kind of same aspect ratio, that might seem more realistic, but for now, I don't think we're going to be seeing a larger screen on the next generation iPhone. As for the back case actually being made of liquid metal, that's a rumor we had been hearing for a while. It's looking like at least the inventor of liquid metal says that's not going to happen anytime soon. He says there's currently no suitable manufacturing infrastructure to produce large-scale parts at that size, and that Apple would likely be years away from being able to use the material in casings. Apple, a few years back, had purchased the exclusive rights to use the material in consumer electronics devices, so a lot of us have been wondering when Apple is going to start actually using the material. The inventor noted that Apple could first start using it to manufacture small component parts like hinges, and Apple has reportedly used the material in just one instance that we're aware of, and that's with the SIM ejector tool that came with the iPhone 3GS. I've never really actually seen hard confirmation that that is liquid metal material, but it is an interesting little piece of design if you haven't taken a look at it or if you've never seen one. There's images online, or if you have an old iPhone 3GS, pull out the little packet that came with it, the little accessories packet with the instructions and the stickers, and you'll find the SIM ejector tool right on there. You can take a look. Later, that was actually replaced with one made from more standard materials, and I think on my iPhone 4S, it didn't even come with a SIM ejector tool at all. But unfortunately, it sounds like we're not going to get a liquid metal back on the next generation iPhone, at least according to the inventor of the material, and he might know about these things. Regardless of what the phone ends up looking like or the specific specifications, I think we can assume that it's probably going to be another successful launch for Apple. Maybe that's a bit arrogant, but if history has anything to prove about it, Apple has been doing very well, and they continue to do very well in the mobile phone space. Research firm Asimco released the latest numbers on the mobile phone industry, and they show that overall revenues are up about 20%, with profits up a staggering 52%. Now, the funny thing here, maybe not so funny if you're the other guys, is that Apple and Samsung are responsible for the lion's share of those profits. Samsung takes about 26% of the mobile phone profit, according to the study. Apple settles for a measly 76% of those profits, and HTC gets about 1%, with the rest actually not being profitable, at least in the first quarter of 2012. Oh, in case you're wondering, also, Apple takes about 76% of those profits by selling just about 8.8% of the devices. So they're not selling the lion's share of actual units, but taking home most of the money. Now, Simco's numbers were looking at the worldwide mobile phone market. If you want to look at just the U.S. market in smartphones, Apple's share has grown 7% year over year in the first quarter. This is according to latest numbers from NPD Group. Apple has 29% of the U.S. smartphone market share, with Samsung garnering about 24%. Despite being the U.S. smartphone leader, however, though, the NPD report does report... The NPD report does point out that Apple has ultimately lost about 29% of its smartphone unit share, sliding from a high of about 41% in the second quarter of 2011 down to the 29% that they're at now. Now, the loss in unit share is obviously something Apple needs to watch and keep an eye on, but ultimately I think Apple has always seemed to be happier with maintaining profitability versus market share, and Apple seems to be continuing to excel on that front. Apple released a small update to its iOS software this week. iOS 5.1.1 came out. It improves reliability of using HDR options for photos taken using the lock screen shortcut, addresses a bug that could prevent the new iPad from switching between 2G and 3G networks, fixes bugs that affected AirPlay video playback in some circumstances, and improved reliability for syncing Safari bookmarks in your reading list, also fixes an issue where an unable to purchase alert could be displayed after successfully making a purchase. The update also addresses a number of security issues, and you can get the update if you haven't yet through the over-the-air update by going into Settings, General Software Update on your iOS device and checking for the software update, or also by using the Check for Update button when your device is connected in iTunes. Apple this week is going to continue the all-out global assault and launch of the new iPad across the world. This weekend, the iPad is going to go on sale in 30 more regions, 23 countries on Friday, May 11th, and 7 additional markets on Saturday, May 12th. The iPad will launch in Argentina, Aruba, Bolivia, Botswana, Brazil, Cambodia, Chile, Costa Rica, Curacao, Ecuador, French Guiana, Guadeloupe, Jamaica, Kenya, Madagascar, Malta, Mauritius, Morocco, Peru, Taiwan, Tunisia, Vietnam, and then on Friday in Bahrain, Egypt, Jordan, Kuwait, Qatar, Saudi Arabia, and United Arab Emirates. By the end of the weekend, the new device will be available in a total of 90 countries. This is the fastest global rollout Apple has ever done for the iPad. Oddly enough, though, the iPad has still not made its way into China, where the thing is actually produced. Though it may be unrelated, Apple does have an ongoing dispute with ProView in China over the iPad trademark. Apple's been asserting that it purchased the trademark from a division of ProView in 2009. ProView obviously claims otherwise and has been disputing it in China. A lower division court there ruled that ProView did own the trademark. Apple has been appealing that ruling to a higher court, and Apple and ProView are reportedly currently in settlement talks, but according to at least one ProView official, they say an outcome is not expected anytime soon. They're not coming to agreement on the terms. On the ProView front, Apple did win at least one battle this week in the U.S. A judge here threw out a request by ProView to have the case heard in the United States. The feeling is that he did that since Apple and ProView are already duking it out over in China. Interestingly, despite the rapid rollout internationally, it seems like Apple cannot combat declining tablet sales. IDC notes that since the holidays, overall tablet sales have declined. They're saying Apple's iPad shipments dropped from about 15.4 million in the holiday quarter to about 11.8 million in the first quarter. But even with the decline, Apple's tablet share did actually rise 13.3%, up from 54.7% to 68% in the first quarter. Amazon, for comparison, was hit much heavier by the decline in tablet sales. Their holiday market share was reportedly 16.8%, and that has supposedly dropped to just 4% in the first quarter. The one major U.S. carrier who has not had the iPhone yet is T-Mobile, and despite not being an official carrier, T-Mobile is reportedly becoming a little bit more iPhone-friendly. T-Mobile has always been very vocal that they have millions of unlocked iPhones on their network, despite not being an official Apple partner. They've also said that now that AT&T is officially unlocking off-contract phones, that they welcome former AT&T subscribers to their network, and course, why wouldn't they? Well, the thing is that they do have some nice pay-as-you-go options, and they have some nice plans. There's an issue that their network has always been in the 1700 megahertz band, which does not support the 3G chipsets that are on the iPhone. That means that iPhone owners coming to the network for data are throttled down to the lower edge 2G speeds. Well, earlier this year, we started hearing reports that that was changing, at least in some markets. There were reports from Northern California, Nevada, and the Northwest saying that the users were suddenly getting full 3G speeds. Well, now it makes sense because T-Mobile says they are moving their entire 3G network over to a more friendly, iPhone-friendly 1900 megahertz band. Not only that, but they say that they will support the faster HSPA Plus 4G flavor, and that the entire network will be ready by the fourth quarter of this year. As someone who's recently played around with an unlocked AT&T 3GS iPhone, I can tell you that the data speeds are very painful currently, but if they can convert over and fully support 3G and even the HSPA Plus 4G flavors, that's going to be really appealing to a lot of customers who have unlocked devices. And I have to say that they can probably expect a lot of hand-me-down and off-contract phones making their way over to their network, and I think T-Mobile's actually banking on that. The next generation of macOS 10, OS 10.8 Mountain Lion, Apple has said is going to be out this summer, but they never really pinned down an actual date. Well, at least one source is claiming that it might be sooner than later. This is coming about because Apple is reportedly hiring and training some new staff members on certain aspects of macOS 10, 10.8 Mountain Lion in its EMA, Europe, Middle Eastern, and Africa division of AppleCare. The speculation is that because Apple typically does not begin training reps until it's a few weeks away from launch, the fact that they're hiring these new employees and doing this training points to the fact that Mountain Lion might be released soon. The reason that Apple typically keeps their internal details of a product secret is they want to avoid any kind of leaks getting out there prior to the launch of the event. The feeling is now that because Apple's doing this training, Apple may announce availability of Mountain Lion at WWDC, which happens from June 11th to June 15th. I think that might be a little bit too soon. Apple provides a big launch window when it says it'll be out this summer, and that can mean any time from June all the way through the last day of summer, which is September 21st, 2012. Typically, when Apple gives a range like that and not a hard date, it usually is later than sooner. But I guess here's hoping. We've been seeing developer builds, and it seems like Mountain Lion's coming along quite nicely. I just don't know that it'll be ready to go and be out full retail in June. And then finally today, a little report about a testing error over on iCloud.com that revealed that Apple might have a new banner alert in the web service. The blogs seem to be making a big deal over this one, although I'm not really sure why. Some users logging into iCloud.com this week got a little iOS-style pop-up notification, test notification, that made a lot of the blogs go into a frenzy. The settings in iCloud were given a similar iOS-style retreatment a few weeks back, if you haven't seen that. So when you go in and click on your name after logging into iCloud, you get this little iOS-style panel that pops up or slides up from the bottom. Mostly, I think the blogs are looking for any excuse to be able to use the buzzwordy word iOSification or iOSification of anything. You know, that we keep hearing that macOS 10 is going to get iOSified, and I think they like to center in on those buzzwords. It creates great headlines and drives a lot of traffic. But beyond that, I don't think it should be surprising that in their web interfaces for iCloud, Apple's trying to bring in some of the design cues that it has in the iOS operating system and even in Mac OS X. The other iCloud news that happened this week is that MobileMe customers are getting a little bit of an extension on their 20 gigabytes of free storage in iCloud. Apple had made that offer for anybody who was paying for iCloud and didn't choose to get a refund when Apple made iCloud a free service. They got an upgrade to get 20 gigabytes of free storage up, you know, in addition to the 5 gigabytes you get for free with iCloud through June 30th of this year. That date has been extended this week to September 30th of 2012. After that, if you are a MobileMe customer who transitioned over to iCloud and you want to retain that additional 20 gigabytes of storage, you're going to have to pay for that. The yearly fee will be $40 a year for 20 gigabytes of storage. You can also purchase for $100 a year 50 gigabytes of additional storage. And once again, that's on top of the 5 gigabytes that Apple gives you for free. So you'd end up with 25 gigabytes or 55 gigabytes of storage total, respectively. And with that, that's going to do it for the news for this week. Before we move on, I do want to take a quick moment and thank another one of our show's sponsors, and that's Gazelle. You know, you can get cash for your old Mac and your old iDevices by going to gazelle.com and just doing a simple search and getting an offer. You could do a private sale, you could do classified ads or auction services, but there's a lot of hassle in that. And if you're like me, you can have concerns over fraud and how the whole process works. Gazelle takes all of that away. It makes the process of getting cash for your old gear and your old iOS devices really easy. You just go to the website, you search for the product, you enter a few of the specifications, you answer a couple questions about the condition, the kinds of accessories that you have, and then right there on the website, they will make you a cash offer for that item. If you accept that offer, they cover the shipping costs, you send the item into them, and after they process it and verify a few things, you get paid for your item. They can pay you by check, by PayPal, by Amazon gift card, whatever you choose. You can even choose to have the value of your item donated to one of over 100 approved charities that they work with. So the process is really simple. It's really easy. If you want to see what it's like and you want to get an offer of your own, just go over to gazelle.com, do that simple search, and try it out. And a big thank you to Gazelle for their support of the MacCast. I have an update for you this week on the NVIDIA GPU issue. We had a listener who had been refused a repair on the NVIDIA GPU issue for his early 2008 MacBook Pro. He was just 14 days past the four-year warranty extension date and had been declined for AppleCare service, was told he was going to have to cover the costs of the repair. I kind of encouraged him to follow up with Apple. We talked a little bit about it on the show, you know, my opinions of the issue. He continued to email and was polite and persistent, escalating his issue up, and it turns out he actually was able to get the repair done by Apple, and they covered the costs. So great outcome on that. You know, I want to comment on that, though. I know that Apple's not going to do this in every case. If you are months past the warranty expiration date, you may still be out of luck. You know, if it's been 2, 3 months, 4 months, it might be less likely to expect that Apple would end up covering the costs. I think the point to remember also, though, when you're getting into a situation like this, if you feel, you know, technically you're outside of the rules of the program, I guess is what I'm getting at. You know, it's not, you can't go in there expecting that Apple owes you some sort of repair or some sort of resolution. It's not going to happen in every case. And if you go in angry, you go in with an attitude, or you go in with this sort of sense of entitlement that they somehow owe you because you're a devout Apple customer and you've spent a lot of money with the company, you're probably going to get nowhere very fast. The other thing to remember is that you're dealing with employees, you know, and you're dealing with people at different levels within the organization. So generally, they are trying their very best to give you a good Apple experience. I don't think anybody's trying to deny you service, but they have to work within Apple's policies, within Apple's guidelines. So in a lot of cases, their hands are tied as well. So, you know, be kind to them, be reasonable about your expectations, be understanding when they give you a response. Don't immediately, you know, start calling them names or hang up on them or storm out of the store. You know, your attitude is going to go a long way toward how you are treated and how the feelings are reciprocated. And if you're not satisfied with what that employee can do with you or for you, I would say it's valid to politely ask to escalate your issue either on the phone or speak to a supervisor, talk to someone higher up within the inside the Apple store. And again, as long as you're polite and, you know, not unrealistic with your expectations, I think you'll be surprised at how far you can actually get and how much Apple will be willing to bend to give you a good customer service experience. But you have to initiate sort of how that's going to go. And having a bad attitude is just a sure way to not get what you want and have a frustrating experience. I also wanted to specifically follow up on the NVIDIA GPU and the warranty extension program, because I got some clarification and verification on some of the policies and the specific pricing from a source at Apple. The warranty repairs, according to this source, were that they do need to be done in-store. So if you're under the warranty repair program, the repairs are actually done in the Apple store that you bring it into. They're not actually sent out to a repair depot. Apple does do the repairs themselves, so they're not sent off to NVIDIA directly, although I still believe NVIDIA is covering the costs for Apple on the warrantied repairs, and that seems to be verified by my source. He said as long as Apple provides a specific diagnostic code that indicates the NVIDIA GPU was the problem, it sounds like NVIDIA is covering those costs. After the warranty period, though, after that 4-year extension period, Apple does have to send the repairs at that point out to the repair depot. They're not done in store. And this would be a repair. It would normally cost about $600 to $700, which I think is sort of replacing the logic board. But in the case of the NVIDIA issue, after the 4-year warranty period, Apple charges $280 for a 13-inch MacBook Pro repair and $310 for the 15-inch and 17-inch model repair. So if you've waited, you know, a really long time, or you're in your fifth year and suddenly that GPU goes out, you're likely going to have to cover those costs. Now, those are the official policies, but as for how long Apple should actually cover these units, I had made the argument on the last program that I think really, because it's a known issue and these models were, in essence, shipped defectively, I think that Apple should cover the repair costs for as long as they need to cover them. In most cases, I would not assume Apple would need to extend a warranty period or cover it indefinitely, but I'm just not sure 4 years is long enough. I think you're going to have a bunch of people that are 4.5 years, 5 years in, going to get hit or plagued by this issue, and maybe they're not ready to completely replace their system at that point. Some people are arguing, and I think it's a fair argument to make, that most laptops, notebooks are replaced within 3 to 5 years, within that 3 to 5 year window. 4 years kind of falls right in the middle. So, hey, that should be okay and reasonable for Apple to do. In my case, the way I see the argument, and I'll try and make this again, I think I talked a little bit about it on the last show, is I really see this as a special case. It's not really in the norm. And as far as it for being forever, I think, yeah, maybe it should be. And the reason is because of the real behavior of consumers. I actually think that only a small percentage of customers will even bring their units back to Apple outside that 4-year window. Most of them are probably going to get hit by the problem 4.5, 5 years in and just say, it's probably time for me to get a new laptop. And they'll probably never even contact Apple. They'll never try and get a warranty replacement. So for the small percentage of people that actually go in and contact Apple and have this issue, I think Apple would come off looking extremely great if they'd simply just service those customers and deal with their problem, whether that is fixing the issue and replacing the parts or replacing the whole unit itself. It's going to be this small percentage. It's not going to be a huge cost for them. And I think it goes to Apple's reputation. A big part of the Apple brand is their reputation for quality and customer service and going above and beyond a lot of other companies. So what I see as a really small gesture on Apple's part in terms of resources, in terms of costs, is going to go a long way to supporting that brand reputation. And in my opinion, that kind of thing is priceless for the company. It should be valued, and typically, historically, at least as we understand it for Apple, has been valued very highly. And I think they should continue to follow along that policy. So that's just my opinion. You know, if you get into the true dollars and cents and acting like a business side of things, you get a different perspective on that. But really, I don't think this would be a huge deal for them to simply cover these systems. And because they went out as defective units, I think it's the right thing to do. And Apple often does the right thing, in my opinion. On the last MacCast, we also had a tip, or really kind of a workaround for the fact that on iOS in mail.app, you cannot send to a group that you have set up in your contacts. You can see that group and you can select individual email addresses, but you can't just simply select that group like you would on the desktop and send out an email to that entire group. You have to kind of pick them one at a time, and it's a little bit cumbersome. So I gave you a little workaround, a way to kind of hack the contacts so that you can make this work. Well, I got some feedback from Michael on that, and he had this suggestion.
Hey, Adam. This is Mike, and I'm calling from Raleigh, North Carolina. I was commenting on the MacCast listener that was disappointed you can't use the groups feature in the iOS email. I also find that to be very aggravating. One of the things I thought of but haven't had a time to try out was creating my list of email addresses and using the shortcuts that's kind of built into iOS, at least in the most recent version, where you can use a short number of characters and it will spew out a whole list of text, kind of like a text expander, but for built into iOS. And I thought of making a email family shortcut that would then punch in everybody's email address, and doing the same for text messages and their phone numbers. So if I want to send out a group text, I don't need to pick everybody every time. So this might work for the caller. I'll certainly try it out when I have a time, but thought it might be helpful. Thanks for the MacCast. Bye.
Hey, thanks, Mike. You know, I actually did try this out. I tried this out before the last piece, and I had meant to comment on it. I think I actually accidentally left it out of my show notes, but it is a great suggestion, a great tip, and makes a heck of a lot of sense. So for those of you who don't know this feature, don't know how this works, you can actually set up little text shortcuts in iOS. If you go into the settings under General, into Keyboard, and then look under Shortcuts, you can tap the Add New Shortcut button. And when the dialog comes up, it gives you kind of two little areas. And the first one is a phrase. And so you put in the full text that you want to come up when the built-in iOS autocorrect feature kicks in. So this is kind of a way you can actually add your own little autocorrect snippets. So you put it, your phrase in there, and then under shortcut, you can actually put in your own abbreviation, to trigger the phrase in autocorrect. So that is actually optional, because you could just start typing the first few characters of your phrase and it'll pop down, or you can actually give it a specific shortcut, more like, as Mike was saying, more like text expander. And so I actually tried this, and I used a shortcut. I added a list of email addresses, and I was only able to successfully get it to work sending out an email when what I put into the phrase portion of that shortcut was a simple comma-separated list of just email addresses. And that worked with some caveats. The one thing I discovered is when I was in mail and I was using the shortcut to enter the to address, I would actually have to, one, add a space after entering the phrase to actually trigger the autocomplete, because the autocomplete doesn't kick in or doesn't sort of autofill in until you kind of have that extra character in there. So I had to put the space in and then kind of delete it back. That was a little bit annoying. But then the other thing that I noticed is once I moved on and started filling out the email, the little bubble, the little token shortened down and showed that I only had one recipient in the to field. And the other thing that happened is, like my other tip, when you just have a comma separated list of email addresses from a shortcut or coming in from the contacts list, when you go to hit send, it'll warn you about having an invalid address. And you have to go ahead and just dismiss that and send anyway. And then it will actually work. It'll send out to all the different email addresses. But as a consequence of that, I also noticed in my testing when I received the mail on the client side in mail.app, it showed in the from field that there was just the one address containing this sort of comma-separated list of addresses, not specific individual emails. So it worked, but it kind of had this funky, clunky, kludgy stuff surrounding it. And I think part of the problem with both of these tips, the one that I gave on the last MacCast and this one, in terms of doing a comma-separated list, is when you're in the to field and it sort of expands and tries to convert your list into tokens, it's not because it's entering in all as one thing. I think iOS is not recognizing that the commas are there and actually separating it into the individual email addresses. So while it works from a server perspective or a backend perspective, it's still not quite the same as what we have in OS X, where we can just simply pick our group and it plugs in all of those email addresses, all the little tokens for us. And I think that's what most of us want. Apple needs to add that into iOS. So hopefully iOS 6, maybe, that'll come along. It'd be nice if they put it in an iOS 5 update. It didn't happen in 5.1.1. I did check that. That wasn't one of the secret updates to the latest update to iOS. So I guess we're going to still be waiting on Apple. But until then, you can use one of these kind of workarounds to make it work. So thanks for the feedback, Mike. As we've discussed in prior episodes of the MacCast, the conversion from MobileMe to iCloud is looming every day. It gets closer and closer to that June 30th deadline. But I got a really interesting email from Susan this week, MacCast listener, and she discovered a situation and something that I was not aware of and hadn't really thought about, but I thought it'd be good to bring up. She had an old MobileMe account and an Apple ID, both tied to the same at Mac address. And that was when she was paying for and using the MobileMe service. But at some point, she decided that she didn't really need the MobileMe services anymore. So she let her account lapse. She let it expire. But of course, continued to use the at Mac email address as her Apple ID for iTunes. So when she would make iTunes purchases, she was continuing to use that account. Now that iCloud is free and we're starting this transition, she was interested in seeing if there was possibly a way to revive that old at Mac address as an actual MobileMe iCloud account, you know, services account, so that she could get her at Mac or now at me.com email address up and running again and use that with iCloud services. And so she had emailed me to see if that was possible. I said, well, you know, I would just try logging in to mobileme.com or iCloud.com and see if it gave you the option to sort of transition that old account, you know, if it sort of was just held in limbo on Apple's servers. And so she did try that, and she found out that her old credentials actually didn't work. You know, it's not that surprising, but that account was no longer locked in or tied to a MobileMe account, or at least not in Apple's backend system. The Apple ID with the at mac.com address still worked as her iTunes login, but it seemed that since MobileMe was canceled, the services were no longer attached to it. And again, once again, that's not really that surprising. Where it gets interesting, though, is she did the next logical step, which would be to contact Apple to support, and they confirmed that the old account was indeed dead and could not be transitioned. As a matter of fact, they said, you know, the account name that she wanted, which she had tied to her at Mac address, was already taken on at me. So another person already had the at me version of her at Mac address. And I wasn't aware that the at Mac.com and at me.com variants were treated separately. I thought they were kind of tied together. Obviously, they aren't. So that really means or indicates to me that the email address that's on either your Apple ID, your .Mac, your MobileMe, or your iCloud account name is literally just that. It's just a username, and it's not necessarily an email address. So it does appear that each one of those is treated as its own unique entity and can be used uniquely, even though Apple happens to use an email address and at Mac and at me, most of us feel are kind of the same thing, because if you've been a MobileMe subscriber and transitioned to from .Mac to MobileMe, you both your email addresses have worked and continue to work in their alias together. But I guess once you let an @mac address expire, it can be separated and reused differently from the @me iCloud address. Hopefully this is all making sense. It's getting confused and jumbled in my own head, but I think you know what I mean. And so in Susan's case, she can continue to use the @mac.com username as her Apple ID, but in moving to iCloud, she is going to have to generate a new username for iCloud. And if she wants an @me address associated with that, she can get that, but it's going to have to be tied to a different username. You can't kind of revive the old Mobile Me address if you let that expire. So just something interesting to note as we make the transition over to iCloud. One of the things that's, I think, happening for a lot of us as we get more and more devices, iOS devices, iPhones and iPads, and even devices that have always on, you know, cellular data internet connections, that those data connections are obviously getting capped. They're getting more restrictive, and more we want to rely on Wi-Fi data. And especially when we're traveling, if you're staying in a hotel, a lot of hotels have Wi-Fi services that you can pay for. Some the really good ones, in my opinion, offer that stuff for free. But a lot of them, it's a pay-as-you-go kind of plan. And it used to be that you could get a hardwired connection, you know, a specific Ethernet cable, and you'd plug it into your room and you could kind of use the connection while you were there. You sign up, you know, daily for the service and pay a certain rate. That's more and more transitioned into Wi-Fi connections, so there's hotel wireless, but you still do the pay-as-you-go thing. Unfortunately, though, the way a lot of those services are is they kind of restrict you or restrict the devices. It's not necessarily that you get Wi-Fi access to go along with your room when you pay that rate. It really gets locked into a single device. And that was something that Chris ran into recently when he's traveling. And he, like a lot of us, has multiple devices and didn't want to have to pay $10 a day for every single device. He wanted to pay $10 a day for internet access for his room, wireless access, and be able to use that with his iPhone, his iPad, and his MacBook. And I think that's a reasonable exception or expectation that often doesn't happen. And so he was asking me, you know, is there a way to kind of work around this when you're traveling to be able to get, you know, sign up for the service, but then use it with all your devices? And the issue here is that what happens often when you sign up, you have to use a web interface. And so typically you'll do it from a laptop, or maybe you do it from the browser on your iOS device. But when you sign up and you enter your credit card information, what they do on the back end is they lock that connection and assign an IP address to your computer, and they attach that to the Mac address. And this is not like Mac, like your computer Mac, for those of you who aren't familiar with this term, but every network interface, your Wi-Fi interface or your Ethernet interface, has a specific unique identifier called the MAC address that goes along with it. And so what they do is they lock the IP address to that specific device using the MAC address, meaning that no other device that you have is going to be able to connect to or share that connection. And when we have multiple devices, that becomes very annoying. And that's what Chris ran into. And so he logically thought, and we've talked about this on the show in the past, that, hey, I can use the internet sharing feature that's built into macOS 10. I have my MacBook here with me. And there's this great feature. If you go into System Preferences, you go into sharing, there's an internet sharing option. And you can turn that on, and that allows you to turn your laptop or your Mac into kind of like a Wi-Fi base station, almost like an Airport Express. The only trouble with this is it only works if you can hardwire your MacBook Pro to the hotel connection and then do your sharing out through your airport. You can actually go the other way around as well. You could connect to the hotel Wi-Fi using your airport connection and then share the hardwired connection to a device, you know, through the Ethernet port on your MacBook Pro or any other device that can connect to Ethernet. But obviously your iPhones and your iPads can't directly connect to the Ethernet port. So we kind of have this little dilemma. You cannot connect to a Wi-Fi network, the hotel's Wi-Fi network, and then share that connection over the same Wi-Fi. And when you think about that, it kind of makes sense because you only have that one interface and you actually need two interfaces to kind of make this sharing work. And so what are your options? I kind of sat back and thought about this a little bit. And the first thing that I thought of is, well, if you just had another wireless card or another wireless port on your Mac, you could probably get the internet sharing feature to work. And turns out that's actually the case. Problem is that most of us, if we don't have the models that have an Express 34 card slot, we have no other way to kind of get a second AirPort interface or Wi-Fi interface into our MacBooks. Luckily, there are USB adapters out there. So you could get something like the NewerTek Max Power 802.11 USB adapters. This is, looks like a little USB stick almost. It has a little stand that you can put it in, or you can just plug it directly into your USB port. And what that does is basically like a little external Wi-Fi card. It's almost like if you plugged in, if you had PCI slots in your MacBook and you plugged in extra, you know, an extra Wi-Fi card. And so once you have that in place, you can actually see that in your network preferences as another port or another connection point. So you could connect the hotel Wi-Fi over your AirPort and then use the software that comes with the NewerTek product to actually share your connection over its Wi-Fi connection and then connect multiple devices and share your internet that way. And I played around with this and it actually works pretty well. The other thing that you could do is you could get a portable Wi-Fi travel router. And, you know, basically like an AirPort Express. And you would think the AirPort Express, oh, that's an ideal solution for this because I can plug that in and then I can use that to share the connection from the hotel. The only problem with the AirPort Express, though, is that it has to be hardwired. It has to use a hardwired connection. You cannot do the Wi-Fi to Wi-Fi connection. The other problem is that you have no way to configure the AirPort because in Chris's situation, it locks the MAC address to that first device that purchases the connectivity, you know, through that web browser. You have no web browser on the AirPort Express, so you can't use the AirPort Express to connect and make the purchase so that the connection would get locked to the MAC address on the AirPort Express. So even if you could do that, the workaround then would be, well, I can clone or kind of spoof a MAC address. So what you could do is sign up with your MacBook and then take your MacBook's MAC address and then assign that to the AirPort Express and then plug in the AirPort Express. And then the hotel servers would see that and think that your AirPort Express was your MacBook Pro. It couldn't tell the distinction because you would have cloned or spoofed the ID. Again, the problem here is that the AirPort Express does not support that feature. Luckily for us, there are third-party portable travel routers that do. So an example would be the D-Link 1350 Wireless N Pocket Router. I did some research and looking up on this, and this does have the ability to actually clone your MAC address. It even has a feature where if you have your MacBook plugged into it through Ethernet, and you're going to have to do that to get the web interface up to configure the settings in the D-Link. When that's connected, they even have a button within the interface where you can just simply clone the MAC address from the device that's connected over Ethernet. So you can copy and paste it over, you can put it in the configuration. And so in this case, what you could do is you connect your MacBook, you use it to configure the router, you sign up for the service, and then you clone that MAC address, and then the wireless pocket router becomes your access point. So you turn that on as an access point, and then you share the internet connection through that with all of your other devices, and then you, at that point, have your MacBook, your iPhone, and your iPad, all your devices connect to that access point rather than directly to the hotel Wi-Fi. So I hope this makes sense. Those were the couple ways that I could think to manage this problem, Chris, and hopefully that helps some of the other listeners out. There may be some other solutions, so if you have a creative solution to this problem, please let us know. Send us some feedback to maccast@gmail.com. And then finally today, I thought we'd end with a little podcast question. This one comes from Brad, and it has to do with deleting podcasts on iOS devices.
Hey, Adam. Brad from West Michigan. Got a quick question for you. Is there any way to delete, let's say, a podcast on my iPhone 4, sync it with iTunes, and have it deleted in iTunes? Because right now, if I delete podcasts on my iPhone, or my iPod for that matter, and I sync it either with a cable or Wi-Fi, it automatically puts the podcast back on the device instead of deleting them out of iTunes. It's pretty irritating, and I don't know why it does that. To me, it would make sense that if I deleted it in one spot, I'd want it deleted on the other. If I delete it in iTunes, it's going to delete it on my iPod, so why not vice versa? Anyways, any suggestions or ideas you have would be much appreciated. We'll talk to you soon.
Bye. Well, I have an explanation and a sort of answer, but I'm not sure it's the one that you're going to be looking for. I do want to start out, though, because I think many people may not even know how to delete content in the music app on their iOS devices or even know that it's possible. So I think we've covered the tip in the past, but let's just review it. If you're in the music application and you see an item in your list there, if you simply swipe across it with your finger from left to right, almost like you're drawing a line through it, you will notice you'll get a little delete button, and you can actually delete that item right on your device. Interestingly, this also works in the video application. So if you have a TV show or a movie, this can be particularly useful if you have a large movie, you finished watching it, and you want to free up some space on your device while you're out and about. You can simply swipe over it in the list and hit the delete button, and it will remove it from your device. But Brad, as you noted, depending upon your rules and how you've set up iTunes, when you get back and you resync, it might sync that content back onto your device. It doesn't necessarily go back and, because you removed it on the iOS device, delete it in iTunes. And I think in most cases, that makes a lot of sense. Podcasts are kind of this weird exception because a lot of us, when we're done listening to them, we don't want them on our device anymore. We want it to free up that space. And so the way that iTunes has classically handled that and sort of thought about it from a podcast perspective, is they use the settings that you define on what podcasts to keep and what to sync and how many to sync. And that's how you're supposed to manage that sort of thing. So if you're in iTunes and you go into the podcast section, down there at the bottom of the main window, there's a button that says settings. And you click on that settings button, and then you can kind of define this rule for the keep podcast settings. And when the little window pops up, you have some different options. And the one that you're probably looking for is the one that says to keep only unplayed podcasts. So once you've listened to a podcast, it will automatically delete from your iOS device. It'll automatically delete from iTunes the next time you sync if you have this setting set. And so you can set that universally, or you can also go in and change it on a per podcast basis. So if you have some podcasts where, you know what, I want to make sure it always keeps every episode, whether I've listened to it or not, because maybe I want to go back and review it, maybe a podcast like the MacCast, then you can set up the universal settings to behave that way, and then go in and adjust individual podcasts to behave differently. You select that individual podcast from the list and then click the settings button, and then you'll notice with the individual podcast selected, there's another checkbox that says use default settings. If you uncheck that, then you have the ability to adjust the specific settings for just that specific podcast. So you can do it that way. I think that's not what you're getting at, though. I totally get what you're asking for, and that feature has not been something that exists, nor that I found a good workaround for. The only other workaround I could think of is to maybe use an alternative podcast catcher listening app on your iOS devices, something like Downcast or Instacast, that gives you a little more ability to kind of better manage those shows. You can also do streaming of your podcast through those applications. So they give you a lot more functionality than what you get with the built-in music player. But I know a lot of people would like the ability to say, hey, if I delete a video on my iOS device, I also want you to delete it in iTunes. Or if I delete a piece of music, I want you to delete it in iTunes and have that syncing feature. But for now, I don't think we have that. If anybody does know a different workaround or something that I'm missing related to this, let us know, maccast@gmail.com. So that's everything that I have for you today. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank all of my show sponsors. Phoronix, makers of Deep Freeze. You can get more information and details on their software as well as free trial over at Phoronix.com. Circus Ponies, check out Notebook. You can get information on the product as well as a free trial over at CircusPonies.com. Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, Disc Label. Also be sure to check out their iOS apps, Text Expander Touch and PDF Pen for the iPad. Awesome application. They have more information and details as well as trials of their Mac apps available on their website over at smilesoftware.com. Gazelle, get cash for your old Macs, your old iOS devices, even your Android smartphones. You get more information and details as well as do a search over at gazelle.com. And VMware, you know, if you have to run Windows on your Mac, it might as well be simple and easy. You can check out VMware software as well as make a purchase over at vmware.com/Mac. And if you use the code MACCAST at checkout, you can save 10% on your order. So check all that stuff out. Big thank you to all of my sponsors for their support of the MacCast. A big thank you to you for your support. If you'd like to further support the MacCast and get some extra content for it, you can check out the member version of the MacCast. As I mentioned earlier, we just finished up an episode on how to repurpose and reuse your old Macs. You can check out that episode along with hundreds of other episodes for small monthly fee, around $4 a month on average, depending upon which plan you choose. But you can get all the details, check out all the plans, and see some of the episodes and stuff like that over at maccast.com. Get details on the member program over at member.maccast.com. And I certainly appreciate everybody who's signed up and become a member. I often forget to say thank you, but thank you for your support of the MacCast as well. If you have any feedback for me, a comment, a question, something you'd like to hear covered on a future episode of the MacCast, you can send your emails, your audio comments to maccast@gmail.com. You can also call in on the listener hotline. That's at 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IM-9. You can leave voicemail there. You can also leave voicemail on Skype. My Skype address is the MacCast. And if you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about in this or any other episode of the MacCast, you'll find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. While you're there, be sure to check out the forum at forum.maccast.com. And if you'd like to follow me on Twitter, twitter.com/MacCast, or you can check out the MacCast Facebook page. That's at facebook.com/TheMacCast. That's going to do it for now. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.